Good morning. Hope you all are enjoying the March snowfall. My chickens were a little bit in shock this morning. They didn't want to even step on the ground. I think they all congregated under my shed. I didn't see them one time when I looked out there. So I guess, who knows, I may not get any eggs today if they decide they don't want to go into the coop to lay them. But anyway, each year I read through the first five books of the Bible, and I usually go on a weekly schedule, starting with Genesis right after the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'm always amazed and inspired when I come to the story of Joseph. He is one of the few, and I know Mr. Petty mentioned this recently in one of his sermons about Isaac, but I think it's more accurate for Joseph that he is one of the few patriarchs that doesn't have a negative thing written about him. Unless you consider that he was a little naive in telling his brothers about his sermon, his dreams. He might have been a little naive, but other than that, I don't think we see anything negative recorded about Joseph. Let's consider the story of Joseph today. I hope you will be inspired as I have been about his steadfast faith and his integrity. Let's remember that Joseph was sort of a linchpin in God's plan for his nation of Israel. He was used to basically preserve that nation and give them a place where they could grow into a large and prosperous people. Without Joseph, they would have perished. So Joseph was used, and he later on realized the purpose that God had for his life after he saw what had happened. But let's go look at his birth in Genesis 30. We'll spend most of our time in Genesis today. Genesis 30 and verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. And verse 23, and she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. And the name Joseph means the Lord shall add. Rachel had been waiting 14 long years for a son of her own. The only way that she had, quote, given Jacob any children was through her maid, Bilhah. Note that this was while Jacob was still working for his uncle Laban. It was at the end of the 14 years he had worked for Rachel and Leah. Yes, back then they had multiple wives, and in this case they were sisters. And some commentaries speculate that this is why God forbade it later on, because of this experience. We don't know that for sure, but it could be. He wanted to leave. Jacob was ready to go back home. It had been 14 years. He wanted to leave and go back home at this point. But Uncle Laban makes him an offer that he can't refuse. He says, Jacob, stay here. Stay here and continue to take care of my flocks, and I'll pay you whatever you want. Name your salary. Name your wages. Just stay here and take care of my flocks. He saw that God had blessed Jacob. And his fortunes, Laban's fortunes, had grown because of it. Now, Jacob knew Laban pretty well at this point, and he asked for something that he knew Jacob could not dispute. He said, give me the spotted, the speckled, and the brown animals among your flock as my wages. He served Laban another 6 years in this manner. And God revealed to Jacob in a dream, we're later told, how he should grow his flocks. And Jacob was given the method of how he should put up certain poles in the breeding areas where the animals breeded. And they produced more spotted and speckled and brown animals. And in verse 43, it says, he became exceedingly prosperous. So God blessed him even more and blessed the output of the flocks that he was managing that were his wages. Notice how Jacob describes these last 6 years to Laban. Jacob is told after the birth of Joseph and after he's worked for 6 years God comes to him in a dream and says, go home. I want you to go back home. And the relationship, Joseph sees his relationship with Laban has grown a little strained. As Laban sees more and more animals that are spotted and brown and speckled, and his flocks are dwindling down, the ones that are white, and it even said his animals were weaker than Joseph's. So Jacob packs up and leaves and takes off. You know, he's out tending the flocks, and Laban doesn't even realize he's gone until 3 days later. And Laban pursues him and catches up to him. And God comes to Laban the night before he gets there and warns him to not harm Joseph. He gives him a warning to treat him fairly. Let's pick up the story in Genesis 31. Genesis 31. And we're going to break into the storyline. This is in verse 38 of Genesis 31. This is Jacob. This is Jacob talking to Laban after he's caught up and they've met. And Jacob and Laban had gone through and searched. He was missing his household idols, it says. And it actually turned out that Rachel had taken them. So Laban had just finished searching everything in Jacob's camp and not found a thing. And at this point, Jacob was getting pretty hot. I'm sure he was pretty upset at Laban. And he says to him, these 20 years I've been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. So he was eating his own flocks if he needed to eat meat. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hands, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, in the day, in the drought, consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So he knew, I guess Laban must have mentioned the dream to Jacob. Laban had changed his wages 10 times, trying to figure out a way that he could cheat Jacob. It hadn't worked. So here was Joseph's first 6 years. Imagine that. He was born at the beginning of the six-year period when Jacob was working for Laban. He spent those years watching his father work tirelessly with the flocks that were to be his wages. So after Laban and Jacob make up and they agree that Jacob is right to leave and right to go home, Jacob then takes up residence in Succoth, it says, which I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation. But it was situated in a valley. If you look it up on a map, it was in a valley on the eastern side of the Jordan River, probably well-watered with a lot of grazing area. He builds a house, it says, and actually builds shelters for his livestock. He then picks up and moves 20 miles to the west. So he moves across the Jordan River over to a parcel and buys a piece of land near the city of Shechem. We are not told how much time went by, but we probably can guess that Joseph was probably still a young boy when his sister Dinah was raped in the city of Shechem. And he probably witnessed that. I'm sure they didn't take him along when they went into the city to kill everybody, but I'm sure he was seeing some of the new people that were part of their camp that had been taken into slavery by the sons of Israel. So he would have been exposed to that. He would have probably been, like I said, somewhere between 8 and 10. We are told then that Jacob picks up the family and he moves south about 20 miles to the city of Bethel, probably wanting to distance himself a little bit from Shechem, get away from that area just in case someone came after them. And then he eventually ends up further south in Hebron, and is actually living near his father Isaac. So much of Joseph's early life was spent in a very nomadic lifestyle, moving from one place to another, probably really never setting down roots in one place, until they got to Hebron. At that point, there may have been several years of stability in his life and his relationships. But when we next see him, he is 17 years old and living in a less than ideal family atmosphere. Joseph has become the favorite son among the 12 brothers because, as the account tells us, he was the son of Jacob's old age. And the fact that he was Rachel's firstborn probably factored into it as well. Let's look at this. Let's catch up with Joseph in Genesis 37. Genesis 37. And we'll begin in reading in verse 2. Genesis 37, 2. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. Notice that even though he was the favorite son, he did work. He did have to do some work. He had to go out there and feed the flock too. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. This would have been Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Sounds like a very unpleasant and stressful atmosphere, doesn't it? Have you ever given or been given the silent treatment by someone in your family? I have, and I've done it too. The Hebrew word here used for hated is sane. It's spelled S-A-N-E, but it's pronounced sane. And the meaning is to hate personally. Enemy, foe, to be hateful, odious, to hate utterly. So that's the word that was used to describe the way the brothers felt toward Joseph. Now, we're not told whether Jacob noticed this, but it is hard to imagine how he could not have noticed what was happening between the brothers. But he certainly didn't take any action and must not have thought it was a big problem. Let's continue down to verse 5. And now this is where he probably shows a little bit of lack of wisdom. Joseph had a dream and he told his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Hear this dream." And he describes the dream where they're out in the field and all these sheaves come and they bow down to one sheaf. And that's Joseph. And then another dream he tells them about is where the sun, moon, and 11 stars come and bow down to him. And at the end of that, verse 10, where he tells that to his father and brothers, and Jacob says to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So next, Jacob sends Joseph to check on his brothers and the flocks in Shechem. Now that was 50 miles to the north from where they were. So here we see another indication that Jacob was clueless about what was happening between Joseph and his other 11 sons. Well, I mean, why would you send your son, the one you favored, to 50 miles down the road to people you knew hated him? Obviously, Jacob must not have totally grasped what was happening. We also learn something about Joseph. He obviously knew how to handle himself out in the wilderness. He probably had to take a donkey, because we're talking 50 miles of hill country between Hebron and Shechem. He probably had to take a donkey and take several days' worth of provisions with him to make it up there. And we also learned that Joseph was a very trusting person. His nature was to trust other people. Because if he had not trusted, just think if he had not trusted his brothers, would he have gone by himself 50 miles from home, where there would be no chance of anyone helping him to see his brothers? I think I would have taken a couple servants with me just to make sure that nothing untoward happened. But Joseph didn't do that. He went by himself. He was a trusting person. So Joseph gets to Shechem, and he finds out they've moved on. They've moved over to Dothan, which is another 15-mile trip. Now let's pick up the story in verse 18 of Genesis 37. Genesis 37, verse 18. So Joseph's coming up to Dothan, and apparently where they were was a flat plain, because they could see him coming a long distance off. And obviously they recognized who it was, too. In verse 18, now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. I like how we're not told who it was that came up with the idea. I could make some guesses, but we're not told who it was that came up with the thought of killing Joseph. Verse 20, come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. Now we really see the depth of hatred for Joseph. His own brothers wanted to kill him. Now, granted, some of them weren't full-blooded brothers. They were half-brothers. But they conspired against him. This is what we call premeditated murder. They thought it out. They planned it. It was not something they just decided at the last minute, like what we call in the heat of the moment. They had plenty of time as they saw him coming across the plain to decide what they were going to do. Can you imagine your own family wanting to kill you? I've never experienced it. I've never known anyone who has. But we have a story of it here, of Joseph. But God preserves the life of Joseph. He had other plans, obviously, for him, through his brother Reuben, who was the firstborn. Verse 21, but Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So he was probably hoping, hey, if I can just distract them for a little while, if we put him in this pit, I can convince them not to kill him. They'll cool down. They'll see that this is not a good idea. But he didn't really follow through, because he obviously was not there when they pulled him up out of the pit later and sold him, because it says he came back and was upset when Joseph was gone. So obviously he rescued Joseph, and then they put him in a pit, it says. They took off his coat, and then they sat down to eat a meal. And who knows, Reuben maybe gone off to take care of something somewhere else. And in verse 25 it says, and he lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So here we're given the name, says to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. But let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And maybe that was part of the argument that Reuben had been making earlier. And his brothers listened. In verse 28, the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Joseph has gone from being the favored son of a great chieftain to being sold as a slave for 20 shekels of silver. Now God puts Joseph into the fire, where he will be refined and prepared for a great position of service. The Believer's Bible Commentary points out how Joseph was a type for Jesus Christ. Quoting, Joseph is one of the most beautiful types or symbols of the Lord Jesus Christ in the Old Testament, though the Bible never labels him as a type. One author lists 101 correspondences between Joseph and Jesus, and another lists 121. For example, Joseph was loved by his father. He rebuked the sin of his brothers. He was hated by his brothers and sold into the hands of enemies. And he was punished unjustly. He was exalted and became the Savior of the world, for all the world had to come to him for bread. He goes from riches and a pampered lifestyle to a slave in Potiphar's house. Imagine what Joseph may have been thinking. Where is God in all of this? Why didn't he prevent this from happening? How could he let me be sold as a slave? Has he forsaken me and forgotten about me? Yet the depth of his faith and integrity did not falter in his new circumstance. He becomes established in Potiphar's household to the point where Potiphar had complete trust in his abilities to manage everything about his house. We're not told how long that took. It could have been a year, 2 years, who knows. But we're told that he did become a trusted servant to Potiphar. Then a test of his faith and integrity is thrown at him. In Genesis 39 and verse 4. At this point, Joseph was still a young man, probably, who knows, 19, 20, 21 maybe. Genesis 39, verse 4. So Joseph found favor in his sight, speaking of Potiphar, and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house. All that he had, he put under his authority. So it was from that time that he made him overseer of the house and all that he had. And the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left everything in Joseph's control. And dropping down to verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. And he has committed all that he has to my hands. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How can I then do this great wickedness and sin against God? How? And just think of that. He's a slave. In most cases, a slave would just think, hey, this is my master's wife. I do what she tells me to do, right? No. Joseph passes the test with flying colors. But notice that despite the years of slavery, his faith in God was strong. And he refuses to be compromised by his master's wife, to the point where he even avoided her presence. We know the rest of the story. Joseph is falsely accused, and he's thrown into prison by Potiphar. So, he did the right thing, and he was punished for doing the right thing. Instead of being rewarded, he goes from being the manager of Potiphar's household to the dungeon. At this point, we would all probably be wondering what we had done to deserve such a fate. Yet we hear no complaints or doubts from Joseph. He was a living example of what Peter would later write. And I'll just quote this from you for you. It's 1 Peter 3:14-17, which says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. And verse 17, for it is better if it is the will of God to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. That's 1 Peter 3:14-17. We don't know exactly when Joseph was put into prison. We don't really know the timeline. It's not given to us. But we do know that a significant event happened to him in his 28th year. Pharaoh becomes angry with two officials in his court, the butler or cupbearer and the chief baker. Potiphar himself, who was the captain of the guard, commits them to Joseph's care. It's interesting, isn't it, that Potiphar, who knows, I mean, how much time had passed, but he actually brings these two men and gives them to Joseph to take care of. I would imagine maybe that Potiphar realized that Joseph was not guilty of what he'd been accused of. Most commentaries seem to think they were in prison for at least a year, since Pharaoh brings them out on his birthday. So they think that, well, a year went by, and then he brings them back out of prison. They both have dreams 3 days before they are to be brought out of the prison. One to be brought back into Pharaoh's service, and the other to be executed. All this happens in Genesis 40. Let's dip into the story and notice what Joseph says to the butler after interpreting his dream. Genesis 40, and we'll begin in verse 14. Genesis 40 and verse 14. Joseph says to the cupbearer, "Remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and I also have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." Joseph never complains about his plight, but we see here that he did not want to remain in the prison. Notice also how he protects his family by not mentioning what his brothers had done to him. But it goes on to say that the butler promptly forgot about Joseph. In Genesis 41, verse 1, it makes a point of saying that Joseph remained in prison for another 2 full years. And the word is there, full. So it says he was there for another exactly 2 more years in prison. Just imagine what Joseph went through for those 2 years, thinking about what's happening. Why hasn't the butler said anything to the Pharaoh about me? We know that Joseph was brought out of prison later at the age of 30 to interpret Pharaoh's dream. Now some might say his best years were spent as a slave and a prisoner. His days of youth were gone. Imagine that. From the days of a teenager till he was 30, he was either a slave or in prison. But had his faith and integrity been diminished at all by these experiences? Well, let's find out. Genesis 41 and verse 15. Genesis 41 and verse 15. Pharaoh says to Joseph in verse 15, "I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it." Isn't it interesting that probably a good thing that none of his officials thought to make up something? They didn't make up something. They just told him, "We don't know what it means." And Pharaoh goes on and says, "I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it." So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." Notice that Joseph points Pharaoh to God as the one who will give the interpretation. His faith in God was as strong as ever, even after all the time he had suffered. His time in prison had not weakened his faith. Genesis 41, let's drop down to verse 25 now. This is after Pharaoh tells Joseph the dream. Verse 25, "Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of the Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years. The 7 good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the 7 thin and ugly clouds which came up after them are 7 years. And the 7 empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do." Drop down to verse 33 now. "Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. Let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine." Notice that Joseph didn't step forward and say, "Hey, I'm the guy for the job. I told you what the dream means. Don't you think I should be that guy that you appoint over the land?" No, he stood there silent and waited for what the Pharaoh would respond. Now we see the real test of Joseph's integrity. We know Pharaoh appointed him. Pharaoh picked him and said, "You're the 2nd man in the land. I'm the only one greater than you." He gave him his signet ring, which is basically how he was able to sign invoices. He was able to spend money. So he basically said, the banks are open and you're in control. You do what you need to do. He was essentially the prime minister of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. So now he's in a position of great power and wealth. Pharaoh gives him a wife, probably a beautiful woman, I'm sure. He's probably living in a big house. He's got a chariot that he rides. People are forced to kneel before him as he comes down the street. So he's in a position to get back at everybody that had done him wrong. Potiphar's wife. Maybe even Potiphar himself. I mean, maybe there would be a little feelings toward him of, you know, why did you treat me unfairly and throw me in the dungeon? Maybe the chief butler. Hey, how could you forget about me for 2 years? I sat and rotted in that prison for 2 years. But we see none of that. We see none of that in the accounts. That time in prison had softened Joseph's heart, and he was willing and ready to forgive. He had no animosity toward those who had hurt him. He was certainly tested by times of adversity as a slave and prisoner. And now he is tested by great blessing and prosperity. Many people, and think about that, he was in that position for 9 years before he met his brothers again. So it had been 9 years, it had been the 7 years of plenty, and then they were 2 years into the famine when Joseph saw his brothers coming to buy food. So he was well established in his position, in his power. And he did not misuse that power at all. There's no mention that Joseph misused the great power that he had. Many people don't consider that people that are in positions of power and wealth also endure testing to see how they will handle their position. They see powerful and wealthy people living on Easy Street with no problems or trials. How could that be a test, some people would say, to never have to worry about money, like Mark was saying. Never have to worry about what house you're going to live in, what car you're going to drive, whether the car is going to start tomorrow, stuff like that. I've never been wealthy or powerful, but I'm sure if we could pull in Bill Gates or some other people in this room, that they would probably admit that it's not all Easy Street, that there are tests, that there are trials, even in the positions that they hold in life. Today we've considered the example of Joseph's faith and his integrity. He endured 13 years of adversity and maintained his integrity and faith in God. Then his life turned around, and he was tested in another way, by great blessings and prosperity. So when you face times of trial and testing, remember Joseph. When you face the test of great power and wealth, remember Joseph. When you're not sure what purpose God has in the trials you suffer, remember Joseph.